can't, just raise your hand or something. So when she announced not to take any notes, one thing that struck me is that people don't remember a whole lot about talks. And not just mine. I remember someone asked about one of the guiding teacher's talks, and, oh, it was really good, didn't use any notes or anything. Oh, what was it about? Well, it was about refuge. And they couldn't remember anything else other than that. And I gave a talk in November, and someone said, your talk was really helpful. And I said, what was helpful about it? I can't remember. So the talks are on the website, cimc.dharmaseed.org, if you kind of want to go back and take notes. I actually have teachers who I particularly like, who I listen to their talks over and over again. It's a really way to take things in. And also, just maybe to take the attitude of, can I find one or two things, and maybe remember them, that I find helpful, okay, rather than trying to take all this in. And this is a rather ambitious talk. So if there are things that just seem like a stretch for you, I'll just kind of put it aside and say, well, maybe someday or something like that. So this topic, perception, is incredibly rich. And I think that's why it's kind of a dense talk, because I have a hard time letting go of stuff that's juicy. So there's this really elegant teaching the Buddha put together called dependent origination. It's very complex, but it really explains how an embodied experiential way we can see how we create this world of form and formless. That we actually do this through our sense apparatus, our minds, our motivations. And I want to just focus on one aspect, well, a narrow aspect of that tonight. And that is perception. And before I try and define it, I'll just say a little bit about this Buddhist model. And it's just that, you know, it's an abstract model, but it's a really useful way to look at practice. So the model is that every moment there's something that happens that's called contact. And contact is when a sense door contacts a sense object and there's a knowing of it. So, for example, I'm up here speaking. That's the sense object. Your sense door ears hear it, and there's a knowing that there's a sound. Okay, and it already, just that very simple model is actually a really interesting way to look at what we think we are, because this goes on every moment. Every moment there's contact, sense door, contact, sense object. It could be vision, it could be hearing, any one of the five sense experiences, as well as in the Buddhist tradition, the mind is another sense. And what it contacts is its own creation, its own thought process. And what happens when contact occurs, in a way I was taught, which isn't quite right, but is that something called perception arises, and something that the Pali word is vedana. I'll use it because there's just no good translation for it. But basically, it's a sense of whether something's pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. So you might look at something, and you might be attracted to it. And if that's pleasant vedana, you like it. Or maybe you're doing meditation and your knee hurts. That's unpleasant vedana. So it's not, sometimes it's often translated as feeling, but it's not an emotion. It's just this very simple, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant, doesn't have much charge to it. Okay? And then the other thing that rises is perception. And what's perception? Perception is a quality of recognition. Consciousness just knows, but perception distinguishes objects. For example, you hear the sound and you've learned that that's a bell. Okay? So perception distinguishes something, gives it a label, and stores it in memory so that the next time you come across that, you say, that's a bell, which is really very useful. Actually, I want to say one more thing before I get to that part. I hit a different bell, but it's still a bell. That's the perception, even though it's very different or somewhat different. So perception generalizes. And this has really significant ramifications for the way we see the world. Part of the reason it generalizes is it's more efficient. The brain uses a huge amount of energy. It counts for 2% of the body weight and uses about 25% of the energy. So if I don't have to figure out that if it's really big and makes this kind of sound, or it's really small and makes this kind of sound, you know, I don't have to think through, is that a bell? And it's the same thing, like if you see the letter A, you know the letter A has two lines slanted like this, and, you know, at least a capital one, another line coming across like that. And you can see all kinds of scripts, but perception just says, oh, that's an A. That's computationally efficient. And it's useful. I mean, it's nice not to have to figure out that there's 10,000 things that we call cups, and you don't have to figure out that, oh, well, this holds liquids. And you know, you have to figure it all out, okay? So like consciousness and like this feeling tone, perception happens every moment. So every moment there's this contact, there's a sense experience, pleasant, unpleasant, nature, and there's a perception. This is what this is. Does that make sense? Okay. And what we think of ourselves is this ongoing experience. And from these simple, the Buddha separated out these particular aspects of experience because they feed other things, like emotions, thoughts arise out of perception. Now, it's not linear, so they all feed each other in sequences. It's very complicated. So there's contact, then there's perception, which tells you what a thing is, a bell, okay? But it doesn't really tell you what a thing is. It tells you what a thing means to you. An object means to you. It's your interpretation through the way your sense doors work, through your culture, the way you've been conditioned. All that comes together to create some meaning to it. So perception isn't just a kind of a neutral, oh, that's a bell. You know, if I hit this really hard, well, then there'll be unpleasant experience. And perception might be, well, that's not a good example. I'll get to a good example in a second here. So when I talk about co-creating the world, the way our sense doors operate and the way our mind operates and the way it processes things creates a world. What's the world like to a bat? A bat sends out sound waves. It hears. If you ask a dog about the skyscrapers in New York, probably couldn't tell you much, but probably could give extended commentary on how various fire hydrants smell. Okay, so you know the way we're wired and the way our culture and all that sort of thing works, we form a world, and the world isn't like the planet Earth. The world is our personal experience. Okay. Now, to get some sense of why this is, I mean, it's so rich in terms of how this is useful. For example, 4 or 5 months ago, I decided I didn't want to bother getting a haircut anymore. And I had a pretty clean-cut look, okay? And obviously now I look a little bit different. And there are all kinds of perceptions that arise from the way my hair looks. You know, someone came up to me and said, you need a haircut. And then someone else came up and said, your hair's getting really long. And I thought, well, what does that mean? Dharma teachers aren't supposed to have long hair, or, you know. And then a woman said, oh, well, his hair is not as long as mine. So we have a perception about how people's hair should look based on culture and conditioning. And other people came up to me and said, well, I like it. And a meditation group I teach says, well, now I look more like a guru. So, but these are all just learned experiences, interpretations. Now, that's a pretty light kind of thing, but take something like race or maybe religion. And remember, perception generalizes. So you see someone who's black or Hispanic, who's male or female, old, young, old white male, old white uneducated male, a whole set of perceptions arise. And from those perceptions, all kinds of thought processes start, and reactions and emotional responses to it. So when I first learned about perception when I came to practice, I was working in a consulting business and traveling a lot. And I started noticing, going through the airport, how I would interpret what people were like based on how they were dressed, how they carried themselves. And, you know, sometimes it's totally wrong. And the generalization that all old white males are like this isn't true. Right? So whatever, you know, you want to pick, or, you know, females, I mean, you know, pick any kind of categorization you want. And this is useful, actually, to start exploring that. How do you perceive people? Based on these kind of generalizations. I work at a gym, and, you know, there's all these big, you know, hunky guys there, you know. A lot of them are different racial mix, and, you know, some of them look really tough, you know. I remember one night, this guy just smiled at me, and I smiled back. And now I do metaphor. I do kindness for them. I don't let them know I'm loving them or something like that. But I generally kind of create this sense of, you know, caring about them. I deliberately form that. I'm forming a perception. And you know what? It really shifts things. They perceive your friendliness. Okay? Now, give you some sense of how we create the world out of perception. I'm sitting up here, and there is a perception created that there are all these objects out here. We call them people, you know, that's another perception, male, female, young, old, and they're a certain distance away. But where is that whole vision taking place? Back here somewhere. The whole image is in the back of my head. And yet, the perception and the way the sense apparatus works is there are these objects out there and I'm here. And there's an inference made that I am seeing. But, you know, you can cut it open. You won't find a little guy in there. You won't find an old white male back behind these eyes somewhere. It's a creation. So we actually create space, the sense of space and separation. That's just the way we're wired. Okay. When I started doing this talk, what I'm going to say next wasn't quite as strong as it is now, but perception creates a sense of past. Out of memories, there's a memory that this person did this, or I did this, or da-da-da. And perception labels those memories as the past. But that memory is occurring now. And the same thing about the future. Through anticipation, planning, imagining, perception labels that as the future. So now, that's probably a pretty juicy talk already. We could just quit, right? We created space, time. You know, what's left? And then we also create a concept of present. So you know, people say, well, I'm going to be in the present. Like a sandwich somewhere between past and future. I remember when I was at I was standing out in front of a pond, and I was watching these leaves blow. And I asked myself the question, well, how do I know these leaves are blowing, moving? And I realized, well, memory says there's a memory that the leaves were there, and now they're there. Now they're here. So out of this memory, this concept of past, there's a sense of motion taking place, leaves moving over time. Now, I don't want to do this just to kind of dismantle the whole world we create, but it has some use to it. This concept of past and future that we create, this perception of past and future, causes an immense amount of suffering. It's an incredible burden. It's not that we shouldn't think about, you know, what might happen, all that sort of thing, but you know, when I started putting together this talk, this is before the election. So how much suffering has taken place for you or people you know out of perception of what's going to happen because of the election? And I want to just sort of appreciate that, you know, some people were really happy about the results of the election. A lot of people, actually, given the percentage vote distribution. And some people not. So this is my particular perception, my particular biases. I woke up the morning after the election. I didn't spend my time watching all night long. I went to bed. I'll get up in the morning. I'll find out what happened. And I was honestly shocked. And then, you know, there was an imagination, projection. What might happen out of this? And then I remembered this teaching of the Buddha. Let go of the past, let go of the present, and let go of the future. There are little blips of energy occurring. And I asked myself, what's happening right now? So this is something that, you know, if you say to grab onto something, you know, it doesn't have to be election, but whatever it is, when you're starting a projection of future, to see that that's a thought. It's a little energy blip. And a lot of those thoughts are programmed, a way we've learned to be in the world. And I'll kind of get into that a little bit more. So recognizing that these are perceptions that are created, they're not real. And it's not to say we shouldn't take into account the possibility these things might unfold, but they're right now their imagination in a world never really unfolds the way we think it's going to. Okay? Make sense? All right. Yeah, just sometimes when you're in a sitting or your day goes through, and then there's this perception of time and like, oh, it's been a really rotten day. Or this sitting will never, I can't stand it. This sitting is never going to come to an end. So it's a perception being created of time and how long is suffering are going to happen while we're sitting. And then someone rings the bell and you know what? It's all gone. Like all the pain just disappeared. I don't know about you. I've had that experience where, oh, you know, I just, you know, whatever, you know, some unpleasant experience is going on, which is the other part of this. And then from that unpleasant experience, the perception arises like, I can't, this is going to last, you know. And then true. So these are things really helpful to play with, to see when you're sitting or when whatever's going on, like it's been a really lousy day or it's a really great day. That's a perception. What's actually happening right now? Because we're creating all kinds of misery. I mean, of course, sometimes you can say, oh, this is a wonderful day, you know, but it doesn't last. So, you know, the way we kind of meet the world is very conditioned. It's not only conditioned by culture and all that. It's conditioned by maybe, you know, someone's born and their mother was in a state of anxiety or depression. And then, you know, it wires your hormones. You perceive the world in a particular way, and you don't even know that there's some other way to see it until you realize somebody else is very different. So people can be claustrophobic. People can be agoraphobic. You know, and you can tell them, well, you know, you don't need to worry. I mean, it's okay. But you can't because that's the way they perceive the world. Okay. So I've kind of said this, but just to emphasize this. So based on mental perceptions, felt meanings, reflex actions occur. So this is kind of the part of the contact. Okay, there's a perception. Maybe you see someone and your perception is that you don't feel safe around that kind of person. So there's a felt meaning, unpleasant sensation arises. And then maybe you do something to get away from that. Or so we all have all kinds of, I think a nice translation is programs, patterns of interpreting the world. Maybe we're always blaming people or blaming ourselves or justifying or feeling inadequate. A lot of practice is to start observing these patterns. That some perception, pleasant, unpleasant experience comes along as well, and then there's a reaction to it, and we behave in a consistent way. I gave a talk on karma and the end of karma, which is on the website, cmc.dharmaseed, last month. It goes in real detail about how to work with this, okay? As well as the one on pleasant, unpleasant, da-da-da. So if you want to explore those a little more deep, I can't go into those tonight because I got some other things I want to touch on. So a broader definition of perception, usually people talk about it as recognition, we label something, da-da-da. But a really broader definition is goes beyond memory and recognition to include the appearance and differentiation of things. So the sense of the subject, object, male, female, even when people are born blind and they get their sight back, they don't want it at first because all they see is chaos. We learn to separate things out. Now, someone finally, for a while, it just really wasn't helpful to restore sight because it was really unpleasant. Some guy figured out that we separate objects out by seeing movement. And he learned a way to train people who were born blind to start doing that. Okay, but objects are something that's learned. Separation is something that's learned. And when you think about that, me, you, the whole way we perceive, we act in the world out is a sense of the way we create this perception. So perceptions don't give you ultimate reality. We can't know ultimate reality. I mean, even scientists can't know ultimate reality because the whole way their logic system works is wired. The Buddha taught that any and all perception is like a mirage. It's an illusion. When early in my practice, I went to a talk by a Tibetan teacher in Harvard Square at the Unitarian Church. And he said, it's all a dream. All this is a dream. It's not real. And somebody said, well, if it's all a dream, why does it matter? I'll never forget that. It just really struck me. And he said, because you're in a dream. So even though it's not real, I mean, it's not, there's still appearances. And we, you know, that's just the way we're going to live in this world of appearances. And yet, it sort of can lighten things up to know that that's kind of a dream world. I could say, you know, I don't have enough time to go into all this. But so the main thing of practice is not to find ultimate truth. We talk about being enlightened, awakened, whatever. It isn't about knowing ultimate truth about things. It's about what leads to inner peace, what leads to being more agreeable with ourselves and with other beings. That's what practice is about. So practice involves actually deliberately creating particular perceptions. And one perception is just to ask, how can we be here with what's actually happening right now? Sense of presence, the sense of here-ness. I think most of the time you read about Buddhism, you'll be told that that the three marks of existence of sometimes reality is that all things are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. Now, that's really cheery, isn't it? Is that why you came here? And you know, until this spring, that's the way I've always seen it presented. And then I read, Ajahn Tanissero came here and gave a talk this spring. You can probably find it on the web. The title on the cimc.dharmaseed.org. And he said, the question was, what is insight meditation? And he said just what I just said. This doesn't sound like the kind of thing I'm in for, you know, impermanence, not unsatisfactoriness and not self. There are skillful perceptions, skillful ways to look at the world, not reality. Now, why is it skillful to look at things impermanent and unsatisfactory? Has anyone here always had pleasant experiences? Has anyone here ever always had pleasant emotions? No. Well, raise your hand, because if you do, I can come up here and give the talk. So the perception, this is normal life for a human being, that things come and go, sort of reduces the kind of struggle with it. You know, it's like, I'm not the only one feeling this pain. I'm not the only one has, you know, joy and sorrow. It's a universal human condition. We're not so isolated. We're not at fault from it. So the way Ajahn Tanissero talks about it, he says, well, we can ask whether what we're going to do is going to lead to lasting happiness, and is it stressful? If it's not, we don't go for it. Now, I've been having a hard time coming up with some really good examples, but I'll give you one that's really obvious. I was getting coffee with a friend a week or two ago, and there was these wonderful looking, you know, pastries and stuff there. And, you know, and I thought, well, yeah, it'd be really nice. And then, you know, there'll be a sugar high, and then I'll crash, and then the mind will come back and say, you know, I wouldn't have done that if I were you. You're just going to gain weight, right? I mean, that's pretty simple, but, you know, people run around chasing sex experiences. And I go through, I mean, look at these politicians, the trouble they get into. Anthony Weiner, I mean, my God, you know? And for how long does it last? And then it's got to go out and get it again. Or, you know, people become addicted to drugs because they want pleasant experiences. And it's because they don't want unpleasant experiences. This is where the Vedana part comes in. I was trying to think of some real life example that sort of fits. And I just thinking about my own career. You know, I was a consultant, very high pressure consultant, you know, made pretty good money, really stressed out most of the time. I mean, that's kind of probably what got me here in a way. And, you know, there were some benefits from it. I made some money. But, you know, one company went bankrupt. You know, I did a good job, but it doesn't help matter. Another company got bought out. And I finally thought, you know what? This isn't worth it. I started my own business. I made much less money, but it was enough. And a lot of this perception that if we just get enough things, we'll be happy, causes all kinds of problems in this world. All the greed, all the you know, they knocked a house down in my neighborhood this morning. You know, talk about impermanence, you know. In 1 hour, it's all gone. And they knocked a house across the street down 6 months ago. So, you know, that seems fairly reasonable, building new house, but there are huge houses now. You know, we got this little ranch and it's going to be like sandwiched between these mansions pretty soon. And are those people really happy because they have a big house? I mean, they have to pay for it. You go into debt. And you know, there's something called hedonic adaptation, which is another nice translation of this word, Vedana. Hedonic experience, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That no matter what it is we get used to it. The glow kind of comes off. You know, you get a new car, it's really great, and then, you know, not so great, you know, after a while. And of course, my car, you know, was sort of new 6 or 7 years ago and got hit out here in the parking lot one night and nobody left a note. And so, okay, it's got some bumps on it. And then, you know, it kind of goes on. Next thing, it's all marked up, but I don't care anymore. It's just really not that important.
So
let me come back to sense pleasures and emotions. There's a discourse called the Satipatthana Sutta. Sutta means discourse. Satipatthana roughly gets translated as presence of mindfulness. So, you know, we talk about mindfulness here all the time, right? This is like an important discourse, one of the most important discourses in this tradition. And what this discourse tells us, there's like four parts to it. The fourth part's really complicated, but I'll just say something about the first three parts. The first three parts kind of tell you to frame things up, to focus on particular aspects. One is the body, and there's a whole bunch of elaborate, you know, ways to, you know, contemplate body parts, contemplate postures, all this sort of thing. You know, and kind of when you contemplate body parts, what's in there, that sort of helps diffuse the pizzazz of seeing someone attractive. There was a guy, Ajahn Chah, who was a very famous Thai forest master, and he was riding in a jeep, and he knew this monk had just come from the West somewhere, was thinking about his girlfriend. And he said, well, here, he gave him a vial, and he said, why don't you ask her to send some of your feces to you? I mean, that's a perception we create. You know, the beauty is like, you know, what, a millimeter thick or something? So one of the things is to focus on what the body really is. And is it really our body? Does it listen to you? Does it ask, how would you like to have a headache right now? Yeah. it's really, so that's sort of part of this other, you know, the not-self piece. Don't claim the body is you because it's inconstant and unreliable. Okay? Vedana, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experiences. Do you have control of that? Well, you can do some work, and it does help to take care of yourself, right? But you just can't arrange it so it's always pleasant and not unpleasant. Thoughts, emotions, they come and go. So these are the three aspects of the focus or foundations of mindfulness: the body, pleasant, unpleasant experiences, and emotions and thoughts. And what are we supposed to do with them? We're supposed to, well, I shouldn't say supposed to, but the recommendation is to see through direct experience that all these things change, are inconstant and unreliable. That is so much about what practice is about. Now, that sounds kind of still not so cheery, right? But there's a capability of awareness that can step back and simply see this stuff, not to get caught up in it, not to feel like, oh, I shouldn't have this, it's all my fault. It's the nature of things. So let's take the example of the election or whatever is meaningful to you. You know, some thought comes up about the future, imagination, anticipation, etc., or maybe about something somebody did to you, and it's got a charge to it, right? Maybe, you know, people talk about their fear, their anger. And so practice is the kind of see that this is simply a perception, a thought arising. A lot of practice is not to focus on the topic so much, but just look to see its impermanent nature. Thoughts arise, they're there for a while, little blips, and they're gone. So this ability to step back and simply see kind of diffuses the power of these things. And it takes a steadiness. This is really a lot about what mindfulness is. It's like we don't come to an understanding of the world because our attention sort of flickers all over the place and we don't see the changing nature of things. So a lot of practice is, you know, just sitting here and calming ourselves, steadying ourselves, is the intention there is to create enough steadiness that you can be with difficult experiences and to see that they come and they go. And a result of that is there's kind of a dispassion. It's not so overwhelming. if you think about all the experiences you've ever had, all the difficult emotions, what you know, the pain in the knee you had whenever you sat, or the back, or itchy nose, or whatever, where is it now? It's really helpful to know that. So we kind of really just widen the sense of perception in terms of time. We see if we can have enough patience to be there, watch the experience. It could be thought, it could be some sense experience, and just see if we can like be there and watch it come and go. And there's a lot of techniques, and if someone wants to ask in discussion about how to do that, which a lot of it has to do with widening and softening widening and softening the area of attention. So the thing that's really difficult becomes smaller relative to the thing, then it's easier to be with it. So like Joseph Goldstein has this phrase I really love. Like, you know, you get lost in a thought process and everything's so terrible, I can't believe this, da da da. And then you say, and the sky is blue. Because the mind contracts around things. It just, so a lot of practice is trying to widen and soften our attention, our body, etc. Okay. And you know, when somebody says something to you, just to maybe pause a little bit and kind of soften, widen, then we might be responsive rather than reactive. So this is actually Vipassana. This is insight meditation. The experience, to let go, to create non-attachment to things through experiencing change. It's something that just takes a really deep, sincere, honest practice to do this. A long time. I spent 2 months at the Forest Refuge just doing nothing but watching impermanence. So widening perceptual field also involves recognizing our commonality, that we all want pleasant experiences, we all don't want unpleasant experiences. We all would like people to be friendly to us, we don't want people to be unfriendly to us. That we all have these kind of same desires in life. If you kind of look at people that way, then maybe, you know, there's a more openness to it, less reactivity. So the wider perceptual field, to look at people as human beings rather than particular race or particular sex or age or whatever, is a sense of inclusive. There's less struggle. In my experience with teaching is that the major cause of suffering in this, that people come here and probably in this whole Western world, is a sense of I'm not enough, a sense of inadequacy. So, and this arises really from this unskillful perception I am. There's a me. And once I am, and that's just, it's a thought. It's a mental act primarily. Once you say there's a me, all kinds of problems arise. There's me and there's you. And there's good enough, not good enough. There's, let's see if I can just take my looks here. Past, future, being, not being, me, not me. These are all perceptions that are created. And out of these perceptions, all kinds of conflicts, internal. You know, I want, I don't want, I want this and this other person is wrong. All that stuff arises out of this perception, I am, which often arises from a sense of vedana, from the sense of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And the response is, I feel. And then from that, maybe a perception goes on and the whole story unfolds. That's why just noticing, there's unpleasant feeling here, rather than getting into the whole process, it can be very freeing. This is a really rich practice, is not only perception, but also just to notice pleasant, unpleasant experiences and see how that pushes you around. You know, you're out in the refrigerator. How'd you get there? Because maybe, you know, you had some unpleasant experience, or you have a cup of coffee and you're tired. So this pleasant, unpleasant experience really pushes people around. So the question is there a way kind of not to be reactive to that? I'm really going way over in this thing here. So the question gets to be, how do we kind of get out of this dilemma? So this is like the karma and the karma talk I gave in November, if you want to look at it. It goes in great detail about this. But instead of thinking about the world as an I am imposed on it, which is a perception we create, suppose we look at the world as a bunch of processes going on. Certain things happen, things unfold, doesn't belong to anyone. So these patterns I suggested looking at earlier, they're not you. So what we tend to think, a lot of what we tend to think of as us, are identifications with habitual patterns that we play out. So rather than seeing like I'm inadequate or this person did this, suppose we see it in terms of programs or processes that have been learned and conditioned. So that takes the me out of things. So something unskillful happens. Well, it was because this is the way one's learned to be in the world. And people who might we might feel are incredibly horrible, obnoxious people have become a particular way in part because of the conditions in which they were raised. You know, if you're raised in a very horrible environment, then you're going to, you know, be defensive, maybe, you know, whatever. You're going to behave. It's a learned experience. And so it's, I tell the story about my first girlfriend who dumped me, you know, and I twice, actually. And, yeah, and I did this practice where you had to list everybody you ever knew and find a way to have goodwill towards them. And, you know, I finally said, oh, well, she's the way she was out of causes and conditions. And it, not necessarily she had a tough life, but maybe she's got a particular genetic structure, et cetera, that made her behave that way. And it kind of lessens the charge of things. We can start understanding what drives things. That if we behave a particular way, this result happens. And there's a capability to pause. There's a little wiggle room where we can say, does this lead to peace or happiness? So a lot of the Buddhist teaching is to create a healthy sense of self or a healthy process, depending on how you want to language it, by cultivating qualities of kindness and compassion. Because if you really start observing how it feels to be kind, how it feels to be compassionate, and also renunciation, which doesn't mean to like, you know, giving up everything you have, but just simplification, not needing so much, and start really observing experientially what's that like. It's freeing. It feels good. I use this example all the time, but it was so powerful where I was in a Whole Foods and this elderly woman, who was even older than me, you know, and she's looking at this milk and she, you know, her hands are shaking, she's got bad skin and teeth, and she came over to me and she asked me if I could read the label for her. It was a very simple act. She wanted to know when it expired. And so I told her and then I pointed out some other stuff, and it turns out mentally she was really very sharp, despite all that stuff. And, you know, it felt so good. Very simple act. And so when we do the, you know, just letting someone out of traffic or hold the door open or something, pay attention to how that feels. So a lot of Buddhist traditions, rather than trying to get pleasant sense experiences, create mental frameworks that create a sense of uplift. That's something we have some control over. Um, And another really important part of Buddhism is just this quality of awareness, just to be able to step back and see, to be non-reactive, to let these experiences come, do what they need to do, and go. Rather than struggling with them, because, you know, you're trying to get rid of unpleasant experiences. A lot of times unpleasant stuff is wrapped up in the body. And the only way to release that stuff is to be with it. To experience. So you want to be able to be with experiences, but not lost in them. Now, so a lot of practice is developing, cultivating kindness, compassion, etc. And then, but no matter how good a job we do with that, we can't arrange not to have old age, sickness, death, loss, da-da-da. So the Buddha says, okay, get enough stability, feel good enough, and this also includes meditation, so that you can see that they're all constructions, they're all programs that have been created. They're not reality. And so then the solution is step out of the whole process, this non-reactivity. Let experiences come and go. Not trying to arrange them to be a particular way. Okay. So we kind of live more in the flow of things. So there's a nice little quote I came across today. Some of this is from Ajahn Suchito, who's a teacher I really like. He says, you realize everything and anything that is held on to can't be ultimate truth. It's just naming based upon position. Now, that takes a lot of charge out of things. You know, we start talking about politics. It's just your perception, somebody else's perception. It's not ultimate truth. So because of that, and this is a quote from the Buddha, this is the end of taking up rods and bladed weapons or arguments, quarrels, disputes, accusations, divisive tale-bearing, and false speech. Because of all these ways we've categorized people and views and opinions we have, this is what the struggle is about. Even, you know, perception of boundaries. If you're in outer space, you don't see any country boundaries, and yet we fight wars over them. And the Buddha is saying, see that this is not truth. It's just a way of operating in the world. So, because this is where these unskillful things cease without remainder, and that is what I teach. So what is Buddha, now this is from Ajahn Suchito, so what is it that Buddhas do know? Everything that arises is dependently arisen, is impermanent and not self, and it passes. And so what? What does that mean? Well, there's no perception for that. Because through insight into perception, the mind has given up naming and has realized peace. If you do the practice that takes you to that, you'll know for yourself. So this is the big end game of practice, is to see that we're co-creating this world. Now, we can't not have perceptions and function in the world. But then we can look at what perceptions are skillful and which ones are not skillful. We can look at, you know, perceptions of kindness, compassion, impermanence, this doesn't belong to me, as a way to have inner freedom of non-separation. So we can bring this kind of perception that leads to inner peace and a perception of compassion. That's where the end game of practice is about. Okay? So I know I've said a lot. I'll stop there and open it up to discussion. It doesn't have to have anything to do with what I said. Suffering and the end of suffering is game in this tradition. Yeah. Can somebody give him this mic? Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.